You're listening to the Triangle Radio Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the August 2018 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Brutal Landscapes by Xander Sherman, with illustrations by Tomer Hanuka. Next illustration, as Toronto police continued to deny what was obvious to many in the gay village, Hank Edzinga and a small group of detectives quietly launched a new investigation called Project Prism. By summer 2017, pretty much everyone in the village knew there was a serial killer in their midst. All of these men had gone missing, each with a connection to the neighborhood, most from social groups that were marginalized in one way or another. Even civilians with a glancing knowledge of the typical serial killer profile by now know that many seek out those on the edge of society, people whose disappearances take longer to be noticed, if at all. Sasha Reed, a 29-year-old University of Toronto psychology researcher and PhD candidate who studies the inner worlds of serial killers, told me that marginalized people are easier to dehumanize, less likely to be reported missing, and often live in proximity to their predators. In the 1980s and 1990s, Jeffrey Dahmer infamously operated within the gay community in Milwaukee by using his familiarity with its members and their social landscape to find targets, while also benefiting from the fact that many of his victims had fewer than average connections to society at large. More recently, the suspected serial killer responsible for the deaths of up to 16 female sex workers on New York's Long Island used the relative anonymity of Craigslist to solicit some of his victims. While the Toronto of 2017 was an undeniably more progressive place than the Reagan-era Rust Belt, it still had its share of the kinds of collective isolation that such killers could take advantage of. Next illustration, going on instinct as much as experience, Sasha Reed theorized the killer would be male, have a blue-collar job, and be sexually motivated. In July, Reed was surfing Ontario's missing adult registry and came across three names, Navaratnam, Kahan, and Faizi, that linked to photos of brown, bearded men. Studying serial homicide, you learn to pick up on patterns, Reed told me. That night, Reed put together a profile of a hypothetical killer. Going on instinct, as much as experience, she guessed the killer would be male, because almost all are. Have a blue-collar job, because almost all do. And be sexually motivated, because the missing men appeared to be of a type, suggesting a preference or erotic fixation. She phoned Toronto police, relaying her profile to an officer who stayed on the line for about half an hour. He revealed that police had received numerous calls about a potential serial killer. Yet, as late as December 2017, 6 months after Kinsman's disappearance, Toronto Police Chief Mark Saunders insisted there was no evidence of a serial killer. As the police continued to deny what seemed obvious to many in the community, Edzinga and a small group of detectives quietly launched a new investigation called Project Prism. By the summer of 2017, they had begun to look more closely at MacArthur, and they didn't have to dig too deep for signs that suggested a history of violence. On October 31st, 2001, police arrived at the apartment of a male escort who called 911 after awakening from a blackout. The victim had invited MacArthur into his apartment around noon that day and was considering showing MacArthur his Halloween costume when MacArthur, unprovoked, hit him in the head with a metal pipe that he had brought with him. "I don't know why I did it," MacArthur reportedly said after turning himself into police. In January 2003, MacArthur pleaded guilty to assault causing bodily harm. He received a conditional sentence, barring him from the village and further contact with escorts. In 2016, MacArthur was investigated for a potential sexual assault, though police set him free without charging him. Itzinga's team learned that MacArthur was once a regular of the Black Eagle, the bar where Andrew Kinsman had worked. MacArthur had both dated Kinsman and employed him at Artistic Design, as he had with Navaratnam. He was also active on gay apps and websites, including Grindr, Scruff, ManJam, and Silver Daddies. He was meeting guys, hooking up with them, employing them, and then, it seemed to cops, disappearing them. In September 2017, a month into Project Prism, MacArthur dumped his work vehicle, a maroon Dodge Caravan, at a scrapyard, taking a cash offer of $150. In October, police recovered the van and found traces of blood in the trunk and on the back seat, according to the scrapyard's owner, Dominic Viter. The results of the DNA test have not been released to the public, but Viter's employees were cleared. Newly unsealed records suggest investigators began to remotely track MacArthur's movements and monitor his calls starting in November. Then, in December, police obtained warrants to secretly enter MacArthur's apartment and clone his computer's hard drive. On January 17th, police reportedly found another link, possibly DNA, that potentially connected him to two of the missing men. He was put under 24-hour surveillance while police prepared warrants for his arrest. At 10:30 on the morning of January 18th, they observed a young man, later identified as a male escort, entering MacArthur's apartment building in Thorncliffe Park in Central East Toronto. Police, who were still awaiting judicial authorization on all of their warrants, moved in. According to the Toronto Star, they found a young man bound, restrained to a bed, but unharmed. The man was freed, and MacArthur was charged with two counts of first-degree murder in the cases of Aysen and Kinsman, taken into custody, and driven to the Toronto Police Service's 51 Division Building for processing. Using MacArthur's client list as a guide, the Toronto Police Service began searching properties across the city, initially 30, and then 100. At a small and neatly landscaped home on Mallory Crescent, where MacArthur did work in exchange for storing gardening tools, police found the planters. In the following months, six additional charges were filed for the murders of Navaratnam, Cahan, Faizi, Mahmoudi, Lisowick, and Kanagaratnam. Though no causes of death have been announced, men who went on dates with MacArthur and survived described submissive role play that became violent. Using online pseudonyms, he told prospective hookups he was looking to see how much you can take and wanted to push till you can't take any more. In 2017, a man named Peter Scromo told CBC News that MacArthur had grabbed his head and twisted it without warning. Another man, Sean Cribben, told Global News that he had agreed to take drugs at MacArthur's apartment, then felt himself lose consciousness. He claims to have awoken to find MacArthur raping my throat and using his body weight to pin him to the bed. When police interviewed Cribben after MacArthur's arrest, he discovered that MacArthur had apparently taken photos of him too. According to Cribben, they showed him bound and in what he describes as a kill position. It has since emerged that photos of the victims taken after their deaths were found on MacArthur's computer. Authorities have thus far collected 1,800 exhibits and 18,000 photos from MacArthur's apartment. Itzigga and city police have been under fire from multiple fronts. What took them so long to acknowledge the murders? Why wasn't MacArthur arrested sooner? How could police let him slip through their fingers after first interviewing him in 2013? When I put some of these questions to Itzigga, he defended the team that worked Project Houston, saying they were out of leads and people to interview. They'd gone through all the tips, he said. There was nothing left. Still, in March, Itzigga sent a report to the Toronto Police Service's Professional Standards Unit in regard to MacArthur's alleged sexual assault in 2016. The officers in that case, who were not part of Project PRISM and were working in a separate jurisdiction, apparently failed to notify the task force about the supposed attack, meaning that at the time of the murder investigation, Itzigga didn't know potentially game-changing information. I didn't feel our procedures had been followed correctly, Itzigga told me. I wanted an investigation to be undertaken. Following Itzinga's report, Toronto Mayor John Tory called for an independent external review. The proposed inquiry will look at missing persons cases, but not the MacArthur investigation. Tory told me this was the responsible thing to do, since a broader inquiry could prejudice MacArthur's right to a fair and impartial trial. Others have expressed disappointment, calling the review a publicity campaign designed to shield the city from any meaningful criticism. In February, Chief of Police Saunders was lambasted for appearing to deflect responsibility for the missing men onto the gay village community, saying nobody was coming to us with information. Saunders told me his comments had been misrepresented. We had received information from the community. Some of that information wasn't shared with us. The comments, nevertheless, led to accusations of victim blaming and calls for his resignation. Saunders is still serving. Since MacArthur's arrest in January, the village community as a whole has been outraged, grief-stricken, and exhausted. A candlelight vigil was held in February. This June, the normally ebullient Pride Parade was expected to be noticeably more somber as participants prepared to wear black to honor the victims. With resentment lingering in the gay community, Toronto police withdrew their application to march. Even as the prosecution moves forward, police are still gathering potential evidence against MacArthur. In May, they concluded a 5-month inventory of his apartment and wrapped up searching nearly 100 properties across the city that he had landscaped, including the one where the planters were found. Additionally, they are going back through a catalog of cold cases. Itzigga has said he wouldn't be surprised if MacArthur was charged with other murders, though no direct links have been made, and the number may change, according to the evidence. When I ask Itzigga how he was refining the search, considering some inconsistencies in MacArthur's alleged victims, he said, "Our filters have essentially been blown out of the water. Two were white, and one went missing east of Toronto. What unites the men is their social isolation, or the parts of their lives that they isolated from loved ones. Lisowick was homeless. Kanagaratnam and Navaratnam were refugees. Essen struggled with addiction. Friends told me that Andrew Kinsman, a village community fixture, had demons. Haran Vijayanathan is the executive director of Toronto's Alliance for South Asian AIDS Prevention and was Grand Marshal of Pride 2018. He said that, from the beginning, police treated the disappearance of Kinsman differently from the disappearance of the seven others. It was like, you guys took this seriously when it happened to be a white person who went missing, but when the other guys went missing, no one really paid attention. Saunders told me this was unequivocally inaccurate. A spokesman for the Toronto Police Service said that officers spent 18 months on their search for Navaratnam, Faizi, and Kahan, and that their investigation included thousands of hours interviewing dozens of witnesses, multiple judicial authorizations, community canvasses, and online searches. A relatively privileged group of friends and co-workers advocated for Kinsman, postering the neighborhood and creating a website. But when a homeless person goes in to report something, are they going to be taken seriously? Vijayanathan asked me, if it's someone who's new to the country and can't speak English well, are they going to be treated with respect, or are they going to be yelled at and treated like they're dumb? In response to the MacArthur case, Vijayanathan's group has set up a safety program. The disappearance of vulnerable people is reported to police within 48 hours. One day this spring, I drove to Woodville, a farming community 85 miles north of Toronto. Like other Canadians, I'd spent the winter wondering how something like this could have happened here, and whether more horrors lay beneath the still frozen ground. I found MacArthur's old house, a bungalow that sits off a main road on a slight hill. It was just like thousands of other rural homes scattered throughout southern Ontario. The question was, what had made MacArthur so different? How had he gone from the clean-cut country boy depicted in his yearbook photos to an accused serial killer? The only person who can really answer that question is MacArthur, if he knows himself. He is reportedly in segregation and on suicide watch at Toronto South Detention Center, a maximum security facility west of Toronto, and has yet to enter a plea. The trial, if there is one, won't start until next year. His lawyer declined to comment. In the same Fenelon Falls yearbook, MacArthur had filled out the standard questionnaire. Favorite pastime? Debate. Ambition in life? To be successful, though he didn't say how. Next to his probable future, he put it, "Your guess is as good as mine." our town. For decades, Boots Riley has been a dynamic voice in his hometown of Oakland, California, which is also the setting of his debut film, the social satire Sorry to Bother You. Here, the rapper and activist takes a ride through the city's changing landscape. Opening photo, Boots Riley in Oakland, California, in April. And he's wearing a suit. His trademark boots with a chain link fence, barbed wire atop it, and a very gritty looking city landscape in the background. We used to drive for hours till we ran out of gas and had to fill up again. All the while, the car never traveled more than a mile outside the bounds of Oakland, California. My friends and I repeated our route as often as we could, as slow as we could, playing music out of car speakers as loud as we could, never taking freeways, because all the stuff that freeways tried to avoid were the things we wanted to run into, get lost in. Other cars with people in them, red lights that might have you stop on a corner where everybody was gathered, allowing you to run into friends you hadn't seen since the last time you passed, pulling over to get the latest news about somebody, get a girl's phone number, anything to fight the boredom and fill the ride, fill our lives with details. Details felt like action and excitement, made the place we called the town feel more like a city. We wanted to feel like this place was important, which would make us more powerful, relevant. The fight against a feeling of irrelevancy was a long-standing fight against city government and many local businesses, much of it centered around access to places and legalities of expression. It was a fight that paralleled the fight going on in many cities across the U.S. Next photos, on location in Oakland. A bravura bunch of recent films has given the city its on-screen due. Fruitvale Station, Ryan Coogler's debut feature film, was based on the real-life police shooting of a young black man, played by Michael B. Jordan, in Oakland. In directing Black Panther, the Oakland native chose to open the film in his hometown. It became America's highest-grossing superhero movie of all time. Blind Spotting, co-written by and starring David Diggs of Hamilton fame and Rafael Casal, this buddy dramedy set in Oakland opened the Sundance Film Festival and hits theaters this month. When we cruised down East 14th, through downtown, and up San Pablo, we would pass the stores, dive bars, and boarded-up buildings that became the third-wave coffee shops, five-star restaurants, and houses of fine bourbon that Oakland holds today, past vacant lots and sidewalks that later became camps of homeless people who had been evicted due to pyramid scheme-like development policies and trickle-down solutions. In those days, when we were just out of high school, there were very few places for us to go into and hang out. Mixed with the lack of jobs that paid a living wage, this made the drives feel like mining for gold. Like we were going to discover something that would change our lives. We would pass out flyers for the parties we threw to hustle up money and feel like we were in the mix. We'd throw in some phrase or sign that this was a party for those of us who wanted to be upwardly mobile. We'd call it upscale elegance, or have a dress code that made it an unaffordable lifestyle for some. We all wanted to feel like things were getting better, changing, but they weren't. We were all still broke and had little individual power over our circumstances. In 1960s Oakland, urban renewal projects steadily pushed out black residents and their businesses, effectively eradicating the city's once thriving blues scene. In the 70s, there were continued efforts to shut down Oakland's pool halls. Throughout the 80s, skating rinks in the East Bay, gathering spots for people of color, were shuttered one by one amid scrutiny from local police. Lowrider gatherings were demonized and pushed out. In the 90s, the ban on barbecues and alcohol at Lake Merritt was newly enforced in a stated effort to stop people who just so happened to be mainly people of color from hanging out. And it became illegal to drive around a lake more than once. When they had the festival at the lake in the 80s and 90s, police would use batons and pepper spray to clear the area of young black and brown kids who wanted to hang out together after the festival closed at 6 p.m. In 1994, the youth rightfully fought back. Around the same time, bars and music venues in Oakland refused to book hip-hop performers or parties that catered to young crowds of color, so we had our events in rented union halls, restaurants, and warehouses. This required permits, which the city answered by banning permits for hip-hop events for a few years. And so, driving from one side of town to the other was all we had for entertainment on some days. The solution put forward by civic leaders to the problems of low pay, joblessness, and lack of access and opportunity always had to do with the mystical word development. Bring businesses in, give people jobs, stimulate the economy, create more jobs. So goes the trickle-down theory, attributed to Reagan but just as often espoused by local Democrats. The businesses that came had very few requisite hires from the pool of historical residents of Oakland, so they just moved people in from other places. The jobs that local people managed to get didn't pay very well at all. But the development happened in the form of city programs such as grants and emergency loans to renovate facades of homes and businesses. If those facade programs were for homes mostly occupied by renters, merely driving up housing values and contributing to eviction, so be it. The development happened, and the direct result was homelessness. Next, photos. Jen, inspired by her Muslim upbringing in Oakland, writer and director Nila Imamin's coming-of-age drama starring Zoe Renee premiered at South by Southwest. And, sorry to bother you, Tessa Thompson and Lakeith Stanfield star in Boots Riley's directorial debut set in an alternate present-day version of Oakland, where it was filmed over 28 days last summer. Homeless camps make notable appearances in the film I wrote and directed, Sorry to Bother You, an absurdist dark comedy with magical realism and science fiction inspired by the world of telemarketing. Like Me and My Friends, the character of Cassius, played by Lakeith Stanfield, drives Oakland's streets searching for his fortune, his destiny, his meaning. To make his rides feel surreal and absurd, we merely had to turn the camera on and show Cassius driving down the streets of Oakland, a town of over 400,000 people, around 3,000 of whom are homeless. Production design, courtesy of decades of city leaders kissing developers' asses. Like people of color, who are often criminalized for simply being in plain sight, Cassius has to deal with notions of his existence and makes adjustments accordingly. Like the fight that generations have brought to the streets of Oakland, there is a struggle happening in my film. So much of Oakland shows up in Sorry to Bother You. Bars, stores, streets, buildings, people, sideshows, fashion, slang, and the struggle. But the struggle is not unique. The setting of my film is Oakland, but the location is every city in the United States. Oakland has always had artists attempting to define the immense beauty and ridiculousness around them. Now it's getting its moment in film because the city is at the heart of the technological renaissance. It exemplifies a certain reality. New technology does what old technology did, just more efficiently. Take the incident earlier this year, for instance, when a white woman called the police on two black men grilling at the lake. Footage went viral from Twitter to Saturday Night Live, but hashtag barbecue Becky has been around for years, and her new iPhone simply helps the cops come faster to get the black folks out of her sight. New areas where wealth can concentrate do not change the relationship between the have-nots and the haves. This won't change until we have a new movement, one that focuses on changing the economic relationship that anchors social conditions. Through absurdity, surrealism, and the specificity of Oakland, many people will find a familiar home in this film. I hope they will drive through the film with Cassius and see their power just beyond the dusty windows of his beat-up Tercel. Resident Evil. As Nurse Ratched and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, Louise Fletcher created an archetypal female villain. With Ryan Murphy's forthcoming series set to carve out her character's backstory, Fletcher reveals the method behind her quietly monstrous anti-heroine by Michael Shulman. Opening photo, Louise Fletcher as Nurse Ratched in Milos Forman's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, 1975. If you had to list the iconic screen villains of the past century, a few names would immediately come to mind. Darth Vader, Hannibal Lecter, the Wicked Witch of the West, Norman Bates, the Joker. The characters we've collectively deemed pure evil make up a rogues gallery of serial killers, monsters, and cackling harpies. Any decent roster would have to include Nurse Ratched of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, who manages to be as terrifying and terrorizing as the rest, without green skin or a taste for human liver. But as far as dark hearts or the totally heartless go, is she really as bad as all that? Sure, she rules her wards as a petty tyrant, punishing miscreants with electroshock and lobotomies. But from our perspective, in the mid-#MeToo post-lean-in era, you could see her as an overzealous working woman, a frustrated bureaucrat trying to maintain professionalism in the face of one R.P. McMurphy, a rabble-rousing psychiatric patient who's been convicted of assault and statutory rape. He's the hero. Ken Kesey's 1962 novel was already considered a nonconformist Bible, as Pauline Kael put it in The New Yorker, when Milos Forman's film was released in the fall of 1975, epitomizing a nation at war with itself. At its center are two opposing forces. Jack Nicholson's McMurphy is a scoundrel, a madman, a trickster, a martyr, a symbol of the wild human spirit itching to break free. Nurse Ratched is everything he's not: orderly, rule-bound, the banality of evil in a crisp white cap. Their escalating fight to the finish was the same one that had split America into two incompatible halves: the establishment and the counterculture. So nimbly did the movie capture its time, 60s liberation doused with 70s vinegar, that it became one of only three films in Oscar history to win the Big Five for Best Picture, Director, Screenplay, Actor, and Actress. The other two are It Happened One Night and The Silence of the Lambs. Barack Obama called it one of his favorite films, alongside Casablanca. While the movie cemented Nicholson as New Hollywood's lovable rogue, something about his antagonist was so frightening, so Freudian, that it lifted her into the realm of icon. Nurse Ratched's soft, controlled voice and girlishly antiseptic manner always put you in the wrong. You can't cut through the crap in her, it goes too deep, Kael wrote. And she's too smart for you. She's got all the protocol in the world on her side. 43 years later, she's about to get a second look. Netflix recently won a bidding war for Ratched, an 18-episode series that will trace the character's origin story, produced by Ryan Murphy and starring Sarah Paulson. One can imagine Murphy and Paulson giving her the same redeeming nuance they brought to Marcia Clark in The People vs. O.J. Simpson American Crime Story. Is Nurse Ratched a feminist anti-heroine waiting to happen? Or is she a monster? If the character still tugs at our curiosity, that's in large part because of Louise Fletcher, the actress who gave Nurse Ratched the humanity she never had on the page, and in the process made her even scarier. To understand how Fletcher and Foreman, who died this past April, made cinematic history, you have to start in the spring of 1960 with a 24-year-old former college wrestler named Ken Kesey. As a creative writing student at Stanford, Kesey volunteered as a guinea pig in a government-funded study of the effects of psychoactive drugs such as LSD. Every Tuesday morning at 8, he would show up at Menlo Park Veterans Hospital, where a doctor would hand him pills and a shot of juice and keep him under observation. Patients straggled by in the hall outside, their faces all ghastly confessions, Kesey wrote later. Sometimes a nurse checked in, looking full of painful business. This was not a person you could allow yourself to be naked in front of. Kesey kept detailed accounts of his trips, the beginning of a lifelong fascination with hallucinogenic drugs. Eventually, he and friends like Neil Cassady would form the Merry Pranksters, whose drug-fueled cross-country bus tour in 1964 became the subject of Tom Wolfe's The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, immortalizing Kesey as not only a chronicler of the counterculture, but one of its most madcap inventors. Back in 1960, though, the psychedelic revolution had yet to come. Once, while he was working as a night aide at the hospital, a very high Kesey had an epiphany. Were the patients actually crazy, or just eccentrics like him? As his former wife, Faye, said later, he began to wonder, you know, what's the difference between the orderlies and the nurse and the patients? And he began to see that they were all damaged in some way or another. Kesey's thinking was in line with that of Michel Foucault, who argued in Madness and Civilization, 1961, that insanity was a construct designed to sequester undesirables from society. The novel that resulted was Kesey's indictment of post-war American conformity. Its narrator is Chief Bromden, a Native American patient who pretends to be deaf and mute and believes that the world is run by the Combine, a kind of authoritarian conspiracy personified by the Big Nurse. Described as a giant-breasted harridan with a frozen smile, big as a damn barn and tough as knife metal. The men of the ward, meanwhile, are victims of a matriarchy. That is, until a charismatic new inmate, McMurphy, riles them to disobedience. The feminist critique of Kesey's novel is long-standing. In Leslie Horst's 1977 essay, Bitches, Twitches, and Eunuchs, Sex Role, Failure, and Caricature, she describes Nurse Ratched as a perversion of femininity, an expression of the fundamental male terror of women who have power. In 1992, the scholar Elizabeth McMahon argued, the Big Nurse happens also to be the big victim when viewed with an awareness of the social and economic exploitation of women. Like plenty of mid-century novels, this one's racial undertones also leave something to be desired. In the chief's narration, the witless security guards are referred to as the Black Boys. Cast in a certain light, Kesey's tale falls into the overlap between 60s psychedelia and men's rights convention, depicting a world in which white men are enslaved by butch women and their dark-skinned enforcers. But there's no question that the novel tapped into a rambunctious energy burbling beneath the surface of American life, so much so that it was banned by school districts from Randolph, New York, to Alton, Oklahoma. The book made Kesey an instant literary celebrity, joining a wave of subversive fiction, including Catch-22 and A Clockwork Orange. Among its fans was Kirk Douglas, who was fresh off Spartacus when he read A Galley and immediately bought the rights. In 1963, he played McMurphy in a Broadway adaptation by Dale Wasserman. The play lasted only 2 months, but Douglas was determined to star in a movie version. On a trip to Prague as a goodwill ambassador for the U.S. State Department, the actor met Miloš Forman, a leading light of the Czechoslovak New Wave. Young, voluble, with a cigar perched perpetually between his lips, Douglas told him he had a novel he wanted him to read. Forman said to send it along. Douglas put a copy in the mail, but it never arrived, apparently confiscated at customs. Each man thought the other had dropped the ball. Nothing happened for 10 years. In 1973, Forman was living at New York's Chelsea Hotel, mid-nervous breakdown, when he got a book in the mail from two producers, Saul Zentz and Michael Douglas. Unable to get the project off the ground, the elder Douglas had handed the rights off to his 29-year-old son. Forman, who had lost both his parents to Nazi concentration camps and then lived under the communist regime, instantly connected with the novel's anti-authoritarian spirit. "The Communist Party was my nurse ratchet," he wrote in 2012, telling me what I could and could not do. Next photo, Jack Nicholson as R.P. McMurphy, photographed with other cast members on the set by Mary Ellen Mark. Ken Kesey, who was living on a blueberry farm in Oregon, had already fallen out with the producers, whom he later sued. Among his complaints, the filmmakers dropped Chief Bromden's narration, and with it the all-important concept of the Combine. Ken Kesey was kind of an enemy of the movie, recalls the screenwriter Beau Goldman, whom Forman hired to revamp a too faithful script by Lawrence Halban. Each morning, the two men would meet by the pool at the Sunset Marquee, bottles of Czech beer at the director's feet, and act out the scenes. When it came to Nurse Ratched, Goldman didn't stray too far from Kesey's ball-busting depiction. "I thought about her like my wife's mother," he says now, "that kind of controlling woman." Control is the operative word. You don't ever think of them romantically or sexually. They use their femininity to control people, and the antipathy towards men. Forman didn't think that Kirk Douglas, by then in his mid-50s, was right for McMurphy. "It killed him not to get to play that part," recalls Michael Douglas, who is executive producer of the new Ratched series. Marlon Brando and Gene Hackman both got the script. Both turned it down. Forman was briefly intrigued by the cheap charisma of Burt Reynolds. Luckily, Jack Nicholson, whom Forman had just seen in The Last Detail, accepted the role. To cast the patients, Forman scoured both coasts, holding group therapy audition sessions. He wound up assembling a dream team of character actors, among them Christopher Lloyd, Brad Dourif, Vincent Scavelli, and Danny DeVito. But two roles proved difficult to cast. One was Chief Bromden, for which the filmmakers needed a Native American as big as a tree. They sent scouts around the country and even looked into the Canadian construction business. Finally, a guy Douglas had met on a plane, a used car salesman from Oregon with a Native American clientele, reported back that he'd spotted the biggest son of a bitch he'd ever seen. It was Will Sampson, a forest ranger from Yakima, Washington, who stood at a commanding 6 feet 7. Then there was Nurse Ratched. In his autobiography, Turnaround, Foreman wrote, "In the book, she is portrayed as an order-mad, killjoy harpy. At one point, Kesey even describes her as having wires coming out of her head, so I searched for a castrating monster." Foreman cycled through star names, Anne Bancroft, Geraldine Page, Angela Lansbury, but one by one, they turned him down. Women, in terms of the women's movement and what was happening at that time, were uncomfortable being the villains, Douglas says. It was only after a year of searching that a little-known actress who had been begging for the role convinced Foreman to take a chance on her. The director thought that her prim, angelic manner didn't seem evil at all. But that, of course, was the genius of it. Next photo, Nicholson congratulates Fletcher at the 1976 Academy Awards, where both won lead acting Oscars. "Want a cookie?" Louise Fletcher, now 83, asked me over her shoulder. We're in the kitchen of her apartment in Westwood, Los Angeles, where she has lived since the year Cuckoo's Nest came out. The decor is more nice grandma than evil nurse. Floral rugs, oil paintings, porcelain figurines. In her office, painted robin's egg blue, her Academy Award sits beneath a lamp. Fletcher makes a pot of tea and opens a tin of shortbread cookies. My little stash, she says. We're speaking only a week after Foreman's death, and the loss is still raw. I wept buckets, Fletcher says, sitting in front of a fireplace. He's very alive in me. I can hear his voice, and he could make me laugh like nobody else. She had not seen Foreman since the late 1990s, but in their Cuckoo's Nest days, I spent quite a lot of time with him. It was about 2 years. I spent about a year seeing him every few weeks to read for the part. In a sense, Fletcher had been preparing to play Nurse Ratched all her life. She grew up in Birmingham, Alabama, the second child of deaf parents. Her father, an Episcopal missionary, had 42 missions in 11 states. On Sundays, he led services for deaf African Americans. Having deaf parents, Fletcher explains, is like having immigrant parents. You feel a special responsibility, and you're a translator. You try to explain the world and how it works to them. Her mother was a movie lover, and every weekend at the cinema, Fletcher would clarify the plots in sign language. People used to tease me and say that's how I got started, redoing old Betty Davis movies. The young Fletcher would dance and sing for her aunt's bridge club, and at 11, she decided to be an actress. She studied theater at the University of North Carolina, and in 1957 moved to Los Angeles with two roommates. There, she met her husband, the producer, Jerry Bick, and acted in bit parts on TV series like Maverick and Perry Mason. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service and broadcasting from its Raleigh, North Carolina studios. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selections by Mark Hoffman.